How did the programme begin? The man from whom I got the story was Kenneth Matthews, who, so far as I can make out, was the first of all the BBC foreign correspondents in the modern sense, but more of that in a moment. When eventually he did come back from abroad, he found himself one of the first editors of From Our Own Correspondent, and here's how he explained it to me.
I was called into the editor's office one day and told, we're getting a lot of stuff in from correspondents which is wasted because there's no room for it in the news bulletins. We should like you to see if you can put some of it together, and we'll give you once a week half an hour to set this out and use it. But I discovered almost immediately that you can't make a programme out of somebody else's waste products, and I got eventually permission to ask the correspondents to contribute directly and specially to this programme.
Who were the correspondents you dealt with at the beginning?
I remember very vividly the first of them, and he was Tom Cadet, who was our senior correspondent. He was based in Paris as our correspondent in Paris.
A short while ago, I said that Kenneth, so far as I can tell, was the first of our modern-type correspondents, although the war was still on and the BBC still had distinguished war correspondents with the Allied armies. He tells the story of his post like this.
The war had come to a turning point. The BBC decided that there would be a corps of correspondents eventually, a corps of resident correspondents scattered throughout the world. And mine was the first. It was to be based in Cairo, because Cairo had just been liberated from the enemy by the Battle of El Alamein and what followed. And there was a fair certainty that as a basis for reporting the end of the war in that part of the world, it would be a very useful exercise. So out I went in the summer of 1943 on one of the first convoys which went right through the Mediterranean. We were bombed on the way, but we arrived safely. And in Cairo, I established myself for a short time, a very short time, because the war required that you went where the war was taking place, and it was receding from Cairo all the time. And that was why I soon found myself in German-occupied Yugoslavia and eventually in German-occupied Greece before the war ended.
But during this period, you did take part, didn't you, in meeting at Tehran between Churchill, Roosevelt and Stalin. Can you tell me what actually went on there from your point of view?
Well, we didn't get to Tehran, the correspondents didn't. This was one of the most secret and important conferences of the war. And I suppose it was my first big story, but both the American and British correspondents who were assigned to the story never got out of Cairo, and the story was brought back to us there. But the world was waiting for us, and I must say the stories we sent out from Cairo about Tehran were probably got a bigger distribution than any other story that I handled for many years.
How did you actually send them out?
Well, it was one of those days when the radio link worked. I must tell you that this was a very dicey operation altogether. The studio was operated by two Armenian engineers who worked very hard and very ingeniously with a great shortage of spare parts. And we reckoned that about one transmission in four was of broadcasting quality. Well, it happened that day when we were able to let out the news of the Tehran conference that the link was in good order. And, in fact, our dispatches that day were broadcast in voice all over the world.
Well, then, for 3 months, you were in the mountains of Yugoslavia with Tito's partisans, and I think later you were kidnapped by the communists during the Greek Civil War in the late 40s. Could you tell me a little more about that?
It was at the very climax of the war that this adventure took place. It was an accident, I think, that I was picked up in Mycenae by a wandering band of rebels, and I was taken for about 16 days walking across the hardest mountain territory in southern Greece, and released only because I happened to have known and to have entertained once the communist general.
But what was the reaction in the BBC to this sudden disappearance?
Well, they weren't very pleased about it. it was represented to me that if you broadcast stories about communist organizations behind their lines, you were encouraging the kidnapping of correspondents in other guerrilla wars.
I don't quite follow the reasoning there.
No, I don't say that I did.
When Kenneth Matthews became a BBC foreign correspondent, it was at a time when no one had yet given much thought to the problem of families. But correspondents are not a special race of men. They're often married, and at any rate in these days, where they go, their families go too, on the pay, pack and follow basis, living out of suitcases or in a dozen or so different houses, with the wives and children attuned as much as the correspondent to the caprices of news and developing hardy, gypsy-like resilience in the face of movement or separation. I asked Gerald Priestland, whose wife and four children trotted the globe with him, how he coped with the problem.
One of my cliché jokes is that you can't be a good foreign correspondent without a good foreign correspondent's wife, preferably your own. It's a very stressful job. And I can think of two or three colleagues, not necessarily in the BBC, who really had to abandon their jobs because their wives simply could not take it. I was very lucky in this respect. But I've always felt that a correspondent must live in his territory thoroughly, three-dimensionally, and this means living with his family in a territory. And this is not just for his own personal comfort, but because he learns an awful lot that way. For example, when I was in India, in the United States even more so, my children were going to American schools. They would bring American children home for tea. Those children's parents would come to collect them. I would meet ordinary Americans in that way who I wouldn't have met around the corridors of power or at embassy parties. My wife became involved in the PTA, in neighborhood family life. She ended up actually teaching art in a black ghetto school in Washington, the only white woman there in the school where teachers were shot in the playground. Now, she learned a lot about art in Washington, and I learned an awful lot through her. When you've built up a traveling team the way we did, myself, my wife, and four children, it does add great strength to the family, and I think it gives the children something that they never lose later in life.
And then I turned to Anthony Lawrence, whose beat was the whole of the Far East.
When I first went out to the Far East, there was only the one man in Singapore. We had nobody in Tokyo, of course nobody in Peking, nobody in Hong Kong. So one was travelling an enormous amount, and that meant long absences from home, and that's never very easy. Fortunately, we found Singapore a very friendly place, and my wife developed a lot of friendships there. And then when we came up to Hong Kong, she took a course in Chinese and Mandarin, of course, which isn't so useful for Hong Kong, but her friends are mostly people who come down from Peking and from the north. But this, again, has made life extremely interesting for her. But that didn't alter the fact that I was always away, or away a great deal of the time, down in Vietnam, and it wasn't always very comfortable down there, I can tell you. Only some years ago, I got over my great dislike of flying. So I was really, in that respect, a terribly bad choice for Far East correspondent. And now I've retired from the BBC. It's a great delight for me because from our house, you can see the airstrip. And you can see all these planes taking off for all these uncomfortable places. And I'm not on them. And this is a source of great satisfaction to me.
Tony Lawrence speaking on the line from Hong Kong. For Douglas Stewart, there was the problem of getting his children actually recognised as being made of flesh and blood.
As a foreign correspondent, you had all sorts of very nice perks. But the BBC was very strict. For example, it took no notice of whether or not you, as a foreign correspondent, had children. I had three. All that it agreed was that a man and his wife had a notional child. And that was taken into account when agreeing allowances. So when I came back from India, I said to our three children, who were then very young, we went in to see the foreign editor, when we go in to see him, you say to him, we are not notional children. We are not notional children. They learnt this off by rote, thought it was very funny, came roaring into his office, shouting, "We are not notional children, we are not notional children," and he had quite a time trying to stop them doing it.
And did it do any good to your allowance situation?
Very shortly afterwards, it was agreed that the number of children should be taken into account.
This close relationship between a foreign correspondent's work and his family life is one of the things that distinguish his job from that of people who are able to keep office and home separate. Another point of distinction is the difficulty any thoughtful correspondent has in getting his role into focus, by which I mean whether he should stand back from the scene or plunge into it up to the elbows, or indeed whether he should attempt both. I asked Christopher Serple how he saw the role.
I always saw my job as resembling that of an interpreter, in other words, trying to explain one nation to another. What I was opposed to was the sort of romantic one-world notion that because the human race has the same physical layout, that therefore it is identical in behaviour and thought. This, I think, is the cause of much of the international misunderstandings which have bedeviled us. So my job, I felt, was partly to identify myself with the people where I was posted, the Italians or the Americans, and then try to explain their ways of thought and behaviour to my British audience.
There are still members of the old brigade of BBC correspondents who continue to cover foreign stories, even though they're now based in Britain. Charles Wheeler had a long career abroad, covering India and Pakistan, Berlin, Washington and Brussels, and has been especially closely associated with television work. When he returned from covering the presidential election campaign in the United States, I took the opportunity of asking him if he regretted that BBC correspondents, on the whole, no longer work in both radio and television, but in one or the other.
I think ideally correspondents should be broadcasters, and they should work in radio and in television, because each medium has its own strength. Each complements the other. I can go out with a film camera crew and film for 3 or 4 days, produce a story which will look quite good in television, no doubt. But I can then sit down and either write a piece for a newspaper or do a piece for radio, which will fill in all kinds of gaps that I couldn't cover in television. So I think ideally you should do both. But obviously in these days of multiple deadlines in radio, where you're expected to start broadcasting at 7 o'clock in the morning, you go on till midnight, and you may have 12 or 13 outlets a day, there's a limit to what a human being can do. And the reason for the split, I think, is simply that, that the workload has become so great that it has been administratively convenient to split them. I was the last foreign correspondent who worked 50-50 radio and television, and I always found it perfectly possible to do it. And I'm sorry it stopped. And now that I'm working totally in television, I miss radio terribly, because there are things I would like to be able to do that I can't do in television.
Well, what sort of things do you miss, in fact, from radio?
I miss the immediacy of it. When I was in America, for example, if I was covering a demonstration, let's say, Martin Luther King March in Chicago, he's stoned by the local Polish community because he's trying to bring about open housing, break open white areas for blacks. And in the middle of that demonstration, there's a call box at the side of the road. And I can go in, I can put 10 cents in, and I can dial London, and I can do an immediate piece with the door of that phone box open, and London can actually hear the noises going on while I'm doing it. You can't do that in television.